And hi there, welcome. I'm Phil Latzman. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN, our weekly mission to keep South Florida informed on local and regional news and issues affecting our community with a panel of the area and the state's top journalists. And this week they are as follows. In our studios here in Miami is NPR's Miami-based correspondent, our old friend Greg Allen. Hi, Greg. Welcome back.
Hi, Phil. Thanks.
In our studios in Tallahassee at our sister station WFSU is the Palm Beach Post's political reporter extraordinaire, Dara Kam. We welcome back Dara as well. Hi, Dara. How you been?
I'm great. Hey, Phil. How are you? Hi, Greg.
Hey, Dara.
And in just a few minutes, later on in the show, we'll be joined by Jeremy Hobson, the Marketplace Morning Report correspondent who spent his week here in South Florida and has experienced a few adventures, which he'll document for us along the way. And it's also your show as well. We're going to ask you for your input on the way people drive in South Florida, which drives a lot of people crazy. So that's our Public Insight Network query, and we'll get to that a little bit later in the show. But if you along the way hear something you like, you can email us at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com, or something you don't like for that matter, thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. You can also tweet us at WLRN, or WLRN.org is also where you can find the online forum. We also have a Facebook page. We have so many different ways to interact. We are just spreading our tentacles everywhere. The online discussion is hosted by our social media editor, Danny Rivero. And maybe the best way to do that is to tweet us at WLRN. We also do have a Facebook page where you can like us, the Florida Roundup, and the conversation continues there. So let's begin, tee it off, guys and gals, with the inauguration, the mentions of gay brothers and sisters and Stonewall, as well as acknowledging that immigration reform would be a large part of his second term agenda. Greg Allen, it would almost seem like President Obama was talking directly to people here in South Florida. It was something we could all relate to when he made his inauguration speech Monday.
It's true. It made us all feel like we were part of the inauguration. But, you know, I think that it's a reminder about how strongly Florida, especially South Florida, came out for Barack Obama in the election. And, there was a lot of uncertainty going in, and not at least of which was among the Cuban-American community. But, you know, we saw, nearly half or around half of the Cuban-American voters voting Democratic and voting for Barack Obama. We have a Democrat representing a district now in South Florida that's largely Cuban-American. Things we've been hearing about this for many years here in Florida about the kind of changing demographics, and we're actually starting to see it here in the Cuban-American community.
We heard him reference the voting issues in South Florida that we're so familiar with. How was it heard in Tallahassee, about 500 miles away from where we sit, Dara?
Well, I mean, it was heard through a partisan lens, as you can imagine, and but I think that, you know, some of the things that the president touched on resonate in, outside South Florida for all Floridians. We saw exit polls showed that Hispanic voters in Florida were 13% of the turnout this election. And we now have two gay lawmakers, you know, one from South Florida, from Miami Beach, David Richardson. But there's also a gay lawmaker. His name is Joe Saunders, and he's from Orlando. The election stuff and the gun stuff, that's all things that we're talking about in Tallahassee. I know we'll talk about guns later. So, you know, the people who like Obama and believe in his policies, they were very enthused by what they heard, and the folks who are not big fans of the president had more reason to sort of grumble.
We heard about immigration. We heard about the DREAM Act, and that certainly resounds here in South Florida. College students and students of all ages that were brought to this country by their parents legally, trying to get an education. Do you think that those types of things will be tops on the priority list for President Obama, who admitted in running for his second term that he had been lax in keeping that promise? In fact, PolitiFact found this week the very same thing. But, dear Greg, what do you think? Is that on top of the list?
Oh, I think it's very much at the top of his list. I mean, there's, you know, of course, the debt, the fiscal matters have to be cleared up. But that doesn't mean that Congress and the White House won't be working on other things. And at the top of the president's list certainly will be immigration. We know that many Republicans, Republican strategists, Republican conservative pundits have said we need to get on the immigration thing here. We need to do something about immigration, looking at the election. However, I don't think it's a done deal by any means as going into Congress. You know, the House will determine whether this will pass or not, the Republican-led House. And John Boehner says this is not a priority for him. He's worried about the budget and the other fiscal matters. Those come first. And within the Republican caucus, I think there's a lot of divergence of opinion on this. And we can talk about, you know, Senator Marco Rubio's role here. It will be key. But I don't think by any means this is going to get through Congress, but doesn't mean the president isn't going to do something on it.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. That's Greg Allen from NPR. Also with us, Derek Hamm from the Palm Beach Post. And speaking of Marco Rubio, the Cuban connection to the inauguration festivities on Monday is Miami-born Richard Blanco, or I guess I should say Miami-raised Richard Blanco, made history on a day of looking forward to a new era, quote-unquote, in the nation's capital. The Cuban-American graduate of Florida International University became the first Hispanic to deliver the inaugural poem, delivering the historic message after President Barack Obama took his oath of office. Here's an excerpt from his poem entitled One Today.
Hello. Shalom. Buongiorno. Howdy. Namaste. Or buenos dias. In the language my mother taught me. In every language. Spoken into one wind, carrying our lives without prejudice.
And Blanco also paid homage to his hardworking parents, the unifying quality of Americans who labored to provide for their families. How do you think that was heard? And I guess it was probably heard a lot differently in Tallahassee. But Greg, how was that heard here?
Well, I think that it's, you would like to say that things don't happen for political reasons, but choosing a Cuban American poet who happens to be gay, I mean, that was a very big statement for the president. I mean, I don't think we've ever seen, it's the first time we've seen something like that. I don't think we've had a gay person making the presidential dress at the presidential inauguration. So, I mean, it's a big statement. It was actually a statement for President Obama, who, as you recall, was dragging his feet on a lot of the gay issues. And so we talk about, you know, about immigration being a failure. He had not delivered on some of those issues as well. And of course, now we've seen some of the things that have happened on that front. So, you know, it was an important day for him as well.
And meanwhile, Cuban-born Reverend Luis Leon, a rector of the St. John's Episcopal Church near the White House, delivered the closing prayer. He also spent some time in Miami, and he urged tolerance and understanding.
But with the blessing of your blessing, we will see that we are created in your image, whether brown, black, or white, male or female, first-generation immigrant American, or daughter of the American Revolution, gay or straight, rich or poor.
So inclusive there. And you know, I think that once you get past all that, Dara, and we talk about the idea of unity and bipartisanship, we start thinking about, can Washington and Tallahassee ever get along on some of these other things that have to be decided with the federal government, including Obamacare, the implementation of it, and the Medicaid expansion, which goes along with that. Derek, can you talk a little bit about how the state is approaching those things and what it needs to do to sort of comply with the federal government?
Sure. Well, you want to start with the Medicaid expansion. I mean, the governor has been really resistant to the Medicaid expansion, and we saw recently, I'm sure you spoke about it previously, but that the governor has been insisting that it would cost the state $26 billion and recently revised his estimate of how much it would cost the state, $3 billion. He says he doesn't trust the federal government to keep up their end of the bargain to pay the full share of it for the first couple of years and then the 90 or 95% in the following years after that. It's something that, you know, state lawmakers are really grappling with because it has the possibility of saving a lot of money on different kinds of spending that we're doing now. We heard yesterday in one of the committees that was listening, that was hearing about mental health the mental health delivery in Florida. And one advocate was saying, in fact, Bob Sharp, who's the former director of the state Medicaid program, he was saying that if the state participates in the Medicaid expansion, that they could move 200,000 folks out of people who are currently getting services from the state into Medicaid for mental health care. These are mentally ill patients. They would be getting all of their regular health care through Medicaid, and it would save the state millions of dollars that could be spent on other wraparound services for mental health. That's a big issue that the state and other states are, and the nation actually, is grappling right, with in the aftermath of the Sandy.
And 49th in mental health funding.
49.
We're going to talk about gun control in a little bit, but this still, Greg, is a huge disconnect. Medicaid expansion, implementing these parts of Obamacare, it seems like it's still the state and the federal government pretty far away.
Well, I think that actually the state and Governor Scott have come actually toward the president significantly since, you know, well, going back before this was passed. And then we had, of course, the president signed it, and the Supreme Court upheld it. And then, of course, most importantly, we had the election. After the election, we saw Governor Scott change literally his tune, but he certainly changed the wording that he used about this. And I don't think, and Derek can correct me, but although he was very much against expanding Medicaid, I don't hear him say that now. Now it's being it's under consideration. The legislature is looking at it very seriously.
And he had to admit that his numbers were way off, and that he's kind of done a mea culpa on that. But still, there seems to be a lot of resistance, not only from the governor, but from the legislature.
And let me just point out one more thing: is that the hospitals want this very badly. There's a lot of money on the table, so he's getting a lot of pressure from the insurance companies as well, who ponied up because they want all these people in the pool. And those are all factors here.
Last word on this, Dara?
Well, the governor he's negotiating with the Obama administration, which I find interesting. I'm not sure why they would be, you know, they want the state to do this expansion, and so he has some leverage there. But he's been negotiating with Secretary Sebelius, the Secretary of HHS, and so he hasn't, you know, discounted it altogether. And I agree with Greg. He has softened his, you know, not just no, but hell no, was really what he had said up until the election approach to it. And, you know, the state, this Sebelius and the Obama administration really wants Florida to do this. And so he is trying to use the leverage of this Medicaid waiver that this state has applied for, which would be essentially a block grant, which would give the state the ability to move all Medicaid patients into managed care. And he's trying to say, okay, if you give us this, then we'll do the expansion. So I think it's still up. Obviously, it's still up in the air. But I think, you know, Greg is right. There has been movement towards that, and it isn't an automatic rejection of it any longer.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup. That's Dara Camp. She's with the Palm Beach Post. Also with us is Greg Allen from NPR. I'm Phil Latzman. A little later on in the show, a visit from Jeremy Hobson from Marketplace on what he learned here in South Florida this week during his series of great reports. And we'll take some of your questions as well via the Public Insight Network as we discuss driving in the state of Florida, a very touchy subject. We're back in just a moment to continue the discussion. And we welcome you back to the Florida Roundup, and your questions are welcome for our panel. If you want to drop us an email anytime, we're at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. We are also tweetable at @WLRN. I know even Greg Allen has entered the Twitter revolution. And what are you? What's your Twitter handle?
At G Allen NPR.
G Allen NPR. I'm at Phil Latzman, and that's PHILLATZMAN for those that don't know, which there are plenty. And Dara Camp, give us your Twitter handle so they can interact with you.
@DKPBPost.
And our Twitter handle is at WLRN, so we do have our live blog, and there's an online discussion taking place right now. It's being hosted by our good friend, our social media editor, Danny Rivero, and you can find that discussion on our website, WLRN.org. And we heard Jeremy Hobson from Marketplace during his reports this week say driving here was not for beginners. And we'll talk about that spurred the Public Insight Network question about driving in the state of Florida and why it's not very good for many people. And we talk about the texting and driving stuff and possible laws. We'll talk about that a little bit later on, and we're queuing up that discussion. So more state stuff, though, to bring up first. Governor Rick Scott says he will propose an across-the-board teacher pay raise to the legislature. He said this week that the raise would only apply to full-time teachers, not other school staff, and it would cost nearly $500 million. And the governor says he hasn't given up on performance-based pay for teachers, but first, they deserve a raise.
Look at the quality of our education system. Look at how hard they're working. Look at the test scores. They're doing a very good job. Now, I believe in merit pay. I believe in measurement. I believe in accountability. And we're going to continue to work on that. But right now, the right thing to do is an across-the-board pay raise for all of our full-time teachers.
And Republican legislative leaders a bit cautious. So are teachers' unions, who say that this is sort of a blatant attempt for him to curry political favor. What do you think the governor's motivation in all this was, Greg Allen?
That's an easy one, Phil. we're talking about the election coming up in 2 years.
A little fastball to hit out of the ballpark.
Yes, 2014, as Dara says. Clearly, the governor, after being a governor for a year, he toured the state and he came back and he said he talked to Floridians and realized that they care a lot about education. And that was kind of he's late to the game. He, of course, made significant cuts in education. Brought back some money his second year, but he's still not beloved by state employees in general, teachers specifically, and this is clearly trying to reach out to them.
Will teachers and educators, Dara, suddenly be persuaded that that Rick Scott is an education governor?
You know, I don't know. I really don't think so. I wrote a story a couple of weeks ago saying that, you know, the Democrats and the momentum they were banking on coming out of the 2012 elections is one of the things that they have, that is one of their big motivators for Democratic and progressive voters, is Governor Rick Scott, who is really loathed, and you know his popularity is very low among all voters. Clearly, this bonus for teachers is, or pay raise for teachers is something, you know, that I would imagine would be hoping to raise his popularity among voters in his bid for reelection next year. But, the Supreme Court just ruled on the pension case,
right,
that requires I guess we'll talk about that in a few moments.
But that is related, though, because many of the teachers, right, say, well, you just took our pensions away, and that's only really replacing that, if that much, you know, $2,500 raise, which, you know, is a significant raise. But you're right, it has to do with the pensions, and he won a round in court on that last week. The teachers unions are I guess trying to say that he was trying to use this to his political advantage now.
Part of the problem, though, is you've got, you know, the unions have done a very good job of holding hands and joining forces on things outside of their purview. The teachers' union came and joined forces with some of the other unions to fight prison privatization, for example, over the past couple of years. And so if you're going to give a raise for teachers, state employees have not had a raise in 7 years. So you've got competing forices. You know, this would be – it's actually, you know, if it – it could possibly be a way of breaking up that support that the unions are showing right now, or they're demonstrating, you know, this hand-holding that they haven't previously done. I don't think it'll work. I mean, I think they're going to be all together. They really do not want to have him reelected in 2 years. So, I mean, it could be a divisive ploy on the part of the governor, but I don't think – I think that the unions will stay together on this.
And his daughter, by the way, is a teacher.
Yeah,
we should mention it.
Well, right. You know, I would also point out, I think that this, to me, reminds me somewhat of Charlie Crist in a way. Here, you know, here's Governor Scott, a man who stood up and signed the bill for merit pay for teachers. This would be something that I could imagine a Governor Scott a year ago would have been very much against if someone suggested it.
Right, like the voting hours.
So he's reaching out to Floridians in a way that I think you could view positively. But at the same time, he's kind of turning his back on some of his earlier principles. And I think there are people within his party who don't appreciate that.
They call it flip-floppery when they're referring to Charlie Crist.
Derry, quickly on the story of the day from Tallahassee, really, is the proposal by Florida House Speaker Will Weatherford to eliminate pensions for new state workers and also eventually converting the pension system to a 401k system. Can you just update us on what's been said there?
Well, that would be, you know, traditionally one of the reasons that folks have said that one of the reasons that they go to work for the state government, which is one of the lowest paying jobs, state government jobs in the country, is because of the benefits of the pension, which is there's a secure benefit. You know exactly how much you're going to get when you retire, and you know there's no question about it. So this would take that away. I mean, this would they would have all new employees after I think 2014 would be in a 401k. That would be susceptible to the ups and downs of the stock market. I don't know if you saw. I don't know what happened to your 401k over the past 5 years, but there's a lot of us private sector employees who weren't pleased with the outcome of that. So I think that's again going to get a lot of resistance from the unions. The governor and lawmakers have strangely keep saying that Florida's pension is underfunded and is in trouble, and yet all the reports that I've seen, and Greg, you know, back me up here, say that it's one of the best, most, you know, secure, well-funded pensions in the country. So, you know, I'm not sure how they keep making that argument.
Right. And in fact, many people, you could imagine the state, if they did make this change, would look at that pension fund and say, well, look, we don't need quite as much money in here now. That could be a potential, you know, source of funding for shifting money around in the future. But that will be a tough battle. If we thought the battle over the pension was tough, the idea of moving the next generation of employees into 401ks will be even more.
I want to move on to one more very important state issue, and this is about ethics reform. There was a bill this week aimed at toughening ethics rules for lawmakers. It went through the Florida Senate's Ethics and Elections Committee. It would limit the jobs that elected officials could take with state agencies and give the Ethics Commission more power. Here's Senator Jack LaValla, a St. Petersburg Republican in the committee. Committee chair who hailed the unanimous vote.
I think I heard 13 yeses, and I appreciate that very much. We will move forward with this bill, and it's got a long road to go, but this bipartisan support on this bill, it sends a real strong message.
And Senate President Don Gates called it the most sweeping ethics reform in more than 30 years. Dara, is this meaningful legislation that has actually a chance to pass, as other ethics laws have not in Tallahassee?
Yeah, this definitely has a chance to pass. It is a priority of the House Speaker Will Weatherford. It is also a priority of Don Gates, the Senate President. It's questionable what they're going to do about the campaign finance reform portion of it. One of the things that is being spoken about is doing away with the CCEs. These are political committees that are leadership committees that basically, I mean, some people call them slush funds, that they can, you know, they're used for all kinds of purposes, and the spending on them is not as regulated as on individual campaign accounts. Contributions to those are now limited at $500. One of the suggestions is to eliminate the campaign contribution limits on those individual campaign accounts. And you would have and require more immediate reporting, like within 24 hours. Mm-hmm. It's very hard. These CCEs are very hard to track because they've got innocuous names like, you know, Floridians for Good Government or, mm-hmm. you know, and you don't know exactly who's involved with them. There is a way to find out which lawmakers are associated with them.
Right.
But we will see – we will definitely see – one of the things that is many people are going to be happy about is giving the ethics commission more teeth. That's something they have sought and lawmakers have resisted it. I think part of the inspiration for this, if you will, was – you know, a future House Speaker, Chris Dorworth, was unelected in 2012 as a large – I think a big component of that was problems that he had – that had been written
ethics
about
problems,
with,
right.
with him using his campaign, his CCE, you know, in ways that were questionable.
All right. So we, by the way, want to remind you before we move on to another topic, but we have this town hall meeting on Florida's legislative session. One of our guests will, in fact, be Senator Latvala and Senate Democratic Leader Chris Smith of Fort Lauderdale. It's a major event. It's free. It's Monday, February 25th, 6:30 p.m. at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. We're going to take your questions on property insurance, education, ethics, corruption, health care. Make Tallahassee accountable and reserve your seat now at WLRN.org and join us again February 25th. RSVP now. We did want to open it up. We may actually talk about the driving now. But, Dara, I know you wanted to mention quickly, and Greg, another big disconnect between the federal government and the state of Florida is about gun control and the fact that the NRA is very powerful here in the state of Florida. And for those thinking that laws like the laws passed in New York or other states are considering would be passed, a very, very dim chance of that happening here.
Well, Dara's in Tallahassee. She can speak more authoritatively, but I would not be looking for gun reform legislation coming out of Florida this year. I thought one interesting comment was that one of the governor, I think, made last week off the cuff saying that he was open to looking at all of Florida's gun laws. And then his office a few hours later put out a clarification saying the governor fully supports the Second Amendment, has no intention of reopening Florida's gun laws.
I think somebody from the NRA may have gotten to the governor there, Dara.
Well, there's no question that there will be no significant gun legislation passed in Florida. I mean, the Stand Your Ground law was one that was, you know, prior to the Sandy Hook shooting, and the national focus on guns was something that the governor had a task force that was looking into. Their recommendations were very minor. We won't expect any major changes on that law. The NRA has been very successful, and Florida has been a model state, first in the nation laws. Stand Your Ground is one of them. And, you know, there's just – Florida's legislature just has no appetite for doing anything that will alienate the NRA or its constituents. So, I mean – there's just no chance of it.
There may be one change. They were going to, as I understand, NRA was going to bring forward a open carry law, a bill this year to allow all Floridians who have a concealed carry permit to carry it openly. That, I think, may not be coming forward, I understand. So one change.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup, and we're tweetable at WLRN. Our Facebook page is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. We also have a live discussion if you're listening Friday at noon, curated by our social media editor, mostly on Twitter at WLRN. And one of the things we asked about this week as we get ready for the new session in Tallahassee, we should reintroduce our panel. I'm Phil Latzman, Greg Allen from NPR, and Dara Khan from the Palm Beach Post with us. We asked members of the Public Insight Network why South Florida and perhaps the whole state of Florida is so dangerous to drive in and what needs to be done to make driving safer in Florida. And we're going to spend some time with our PIN listeners in just a moment, but here's one of the responses we got via Google Voice.
I'm active duty military stationed here in Florida. By UCMJ rules and laws, we are not permitted to text while driving. I don't see why in Florida they can't pass this law. I've been stationed in California, D.C., where it's against the law to text and drive. Everybody, it's so much safer. It's so much better. I am sick and tired of being in intersections where people do not pay attention to the roads and they're busy texting while cars go by.
If you're behind the wheel of your car and in one of your hands you have a burger, a lipstick, a hot cup of coffee, or a cell phone, B, are being distracted by a phone conversation, C, are trying to read a text or are actually texting yourself, or D, all of the above, Then you have turned your two-ton vehicle into a weapon.
So there we heard from Chief Petty Officer Gabe Puello from Miami and then Eileen Flaxman from Valhalla on texting and driving. Will they ever happen in Florida? Well, there's a key lawmaker that says this will be the year it happens. State Senator and Republican from Venice, Nancy Dietert, says the bill bans drivers from sending or receiving messages while driving. Under the law, drivers still be able to read navigational devices or weather alerts. Well, it'll be hard to tell, I guess. It's going to be all kinds of gray areas. Texting while driving would be punishable by a $30 fine. $30. Meanwhile, you could make a right turn without stopping on red and get fined for $200. But anyway, Dietert says the bill has passed in the Senate twice but has never been heard in the House.
This year is going to be our year. We have a good House sponsor. We have a good Speaker of the House. Good Senate President, so the no texting while driving bill, I hope, will pass this year.
All right, so if this bill passes, what exactly would change? It doesn't seem like there's a big penalty there. Would it be a primary offense, Dara?
Senator Dietert's law would make it a secondary offense, so that means you would have to be pulled over for something else in order for them to ticket you for texting and driving. I think that, you know, House Speaker Dean Cannon, someone was asking me if this is something that was hadn't passed because the telecom lobby had, you know, kept it from ever getting heard. And I really think that this was more of a libertarian, you know, no more government in our private lives. We don't need the government telling us what to do thing, particularly on the House side. And the Speaker Dean Cannon, who's gone now. And I have to say that he is a big texter. I've never seen him texting and driving. I'm not accusing the speaker. If you're listening, I'm not accusing you of texting
and
driving.
Well, that's the thing about this. Everybody's done it. I mean, unfortunately, you know, some of us stop at lights and do it. But if that, I mean, some of us are sitting in the, and I peered over the other day, and I think I tweeted this out. Saw somebody just, after I pulled over, by the way, I'm not doing it while I'm driving. But somebody just holding their phone over their steering wheel. I mean, everybody does it because there's no law. And until the seatbelt law was passed a couple of years ago that made it a primary offense, not a secondary offense, nobody was putting on their seatbelts. So it's pretty obvious that that's what's – I mean it's just, it seems pretty obvious, doesn't it?
I think what might be easier to pass, and I don't know if her bill will pass, but I think what we might see would be a restriction on young drivers, because I think that's something that you can hardly argue against. You know, why wouldn't you say people who – you know, drivers under 18, make it a primary offense for them, perhaps. So it seems as though even now, you know, the telecom companies are getting on board, the insurance companies are getting on board, they're asking for it. You know, the National Department of Transportation Secretary has asked for states to pass these laws. Right. So, I think it does have a good chance. Something has a good chance.
We're going to watch that. And by the way, Florida has higher traffic fatality rates than the national average. Only one of 11 states not to have laws banning texting while driving, and insurance rates are a lot higher here, about $600 more on national average, and 23 times more likely to get into an accident if you are texting and driving. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to some folks about driving in Florida, whether if it's texting and driving or just why people just can't seem to drive here. We'll hear from our listeners through the Public Insight Network, and Jeremy Hobson from Marketplace joins us as well. We're back in just a moment. And welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman, our guest this hour. Greg Allen from NPR, Derek Kam from the Palm Beach Post, and now joining us in the studio after his week, a little bit darker than he was when he got here on Mondays, Marketplace correspondent Jeremy Hobson. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi,
welcome.
Phil.
So before we reach out to our Public Insight Network listeners and readers on the driving, you brought this up this week as a visitor. What did you notice?
Yeah, well, we drove up to do a story in Sunrise, Florida, and got onto these series of highways. And I couldn't believe, first of all, at the amount of construction that was going on. but also how busy the highways were on Martin Luther King Day and the fact that people were cutting us off all over the place. And it seemed like, I mean, you expect that sort of thing in New York or in Boston, but I always sort of think of, you know, the beach, everyone's relaxed. Why are people so aggressive on the roads?
Well, that spurred the conversation. We said, well, why is South Florida such a tough place to drive in? What makes it so dangerous to drive here? Because I think everybody agrees it's pretty dangerous. And what needs to be done to make driving safer in Florida? And that is the question that we asked our members of the Public Insight Network. We talked about the texting while driving, and we're really kind of moving past that, obviously, to some other things that could be done, attitudes, adjustments, perhaps traffic enforcement laws, stuff like that. Anyway, so Kai is an air traffic controller from Pembroke Pines, and he is first to join us here via the Public Insight Network. Hi, Kai. Welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So you actually have trained, I see, in high-performance driving. You've instructed drivers in autocross. What is that training like, and does it give you a background for driving in South Florida?
Well, I'd hate to say that having high-performance driving experience would prepare you for driving in Florida, would be the thing that you need to prepare yourself for driving in Florida, but I can't tell you how many times it has helped me either avoid accidents or whatnot. High-performance driver training is essentially car clubs will rent out a racetrack, Homestead, or up north, and they'll you actually go, you take your car with an instructor onto the racetrack, and they teach you how to drive in a racing style. So
like at the Homestead Motor Speedway, for instance.
But yeah,
do you think people maybe take that practice for, you know, I mean, driving on I-95? Or, I mean, what could be done, do you think, to make Florida safer to drive? And what do you think about the average driver that you're riding up against?
Well, let me say the high-performance driving experiences, they actually teach you to, more than anything, to respect your car and yourself and your own abilities. And I was asked, one of the reasons I think that there's such an issue of driving down in South Florida is because there's such a conglomeration of people from all over the place. Jeremy, you're from New York City, and I'm from New York City. I learned how to drive in New York City. And one of the things I will say from driving up there is, while it seems crazy, for most of the people who drive in New York, you kind of know what to expect when you're there. You're always looking out for, you know, you're always looking over your shoulder. You're always looking out for your back. And kind of hear people get on the highway. They get on I-75. They drive 90 miles an hour. They set themselves on cruise control, and they zone out.
Well, the other thing is, I mean, I used to live in Los Angeles as well. And in L.A., in California, there are such strict laws that have to be obeyed by the drivers that you get to an intersection, for example, and you can't turn right at an intersection until the pedestrian that is crossing the street has gone all the way from one side to the other.
Jaywalking.
Exactly. And I didn't see any of that here. It's a much more aggressive drive. The other thing is, I have to say, I'm really surprised that there's even a debate going on in Florida about a texting while driving law. That seems like it's pretty much a given.
Welcome to the Sunshine State.
Yeah. But, you know, all over the country, that's a given. You've got to have it.
Well, this is why it spurred the conversation along. Let's move on to Tracy, who is, and thanks very much, Kai, for your call. We hope we got some of the answer there. Tracy is a realtor from Tavernier, joining us from the Keys. Tracy, you drive a lot. Anybody in the Keys has to drive up and down the Overseas Highway, and that can always be treacherous as well.
It certainly can. Many sections of it are simply a two-lane road where the likelihood of having a head-on collision are pretty high.
Right, and a lot of people may not be in their correct states as well, coming back and forth, possibly from bars, and, you know, obviously you've got that issue. But what you think, you'd be safer, especially down there in the Keys, if they banned texting while driving?
Well, I think they would have to do something like that, because a lot of the accidents that we see down here in the Florida Keys are tourists. And because they're either not familiar with where they're going, or they get onto a bridge and they go, oh, look, there's water, let's look at the water. So they get distracted by looking at the water. And then they get a text message. So now they're looking at the water and reading a text message, and they are not looking at the road.
Yeah.
So I'm fully behind a ban on texting, and I would make it a primary offense and not a secondary offense.
Well, Tracy, thanks very much for your call.
All right, you're welcome.
Greg?
Well, you know, what Jeremy says about you couldn't believe it. I mean, the texting thing, you know, we forget that there actually are people within the state of Florida who will follow the law if you pass the law. They will stop texting. I mean, I'm not saying it's a huge number, but there are some people out there.
Me.
We start with that group, right? and then the idea that you build some kind of public consensus toward it, you know. And I will just say one other thing. The one thing that I think has helped driving here more than anything in the last several years has been, this won't make me popular, red light cameras. Is that your chances of being hit broadside by someone blowing through a red light has gone down somewhat in Florida since those have come in.
And Christopher joins us via the Public Insight Network as well. And Christopher, you've used your cell phone and texted while driving. Is that what you're saying, sir?
Yes, Phil. I admit
it's
I
not
have.
Funny, actually, but it's amusing that we're sitting as everybody does it. Even you know because it is
finally
not against
someone
the law.
Admits to it.
Yeah.
Oh no. Well, I do have Bluetooth for my voice use
right.
of my cell phone. I try very hard not to pick up a phone. But I have been known to stop, as you do, at a red light and take a quick glance at my texts or emails, and in fact even have been guilty of sending some out while on the road.
Hmm.
I'm not happy to admit that, but I do agree with several of the points that have already been made. A law, a primary felony or a misdemeanor, primary penalty law would certainly curb, if not stop that. I also agree with the most recent comment that was made that the red light cameras are significantly reducing the people running
right.
through those red lights. And for a good example, down here, in the south of the city of Miami, anytime you're trying to cross US 1, you get people blocking the intersections, and those red light cameras are now stopping them
yeah.
and prohibiting them from blocking us when a cross street gets a green light. Many times those used to be blocked by people trying to go north or south.
Right.
But clearly, I think it goes beyond texting.
Yeah, I think we all agree on that. We all agree that it's more than just texting.
In the past 2 years. After 30 years of driving in South Florida, two accidents in the past 24 months where people hit me, and it was only because they were in this me-first mentality. There was a complete lack of courtesy, a complete lack of respect for other drivers. They were always about them being in a hurry to get ahead or get an advantage or do something on the road where they got to get ahead of the next guy.
Well,
or in one case, one guy so distracted by wanting to be where he was going, not by texting, not even by putting on makeup or drinking coffee, but just he said to me and the policeman, he said, well, I was just concentrating on getting where I was going, and
yeah.
he hit me in the rear. He didn't even bother to stop looking at me.
Yeah. Well, Christopher, I tell you what, there's so many stories, and I wish we had time to get to everybody's stories on this, but I do appreciate you calling in and giving us your account, because I think we could all relate to that, driving in South Florida. So, Jeremy, did we, and thanks for your call, did we answer some of the questions here? And what else, besides the driving, now we're going to talk to you about, what else did you discover about Florida while you were here this
week? Well, you know, we came down here with our Marketplace Wealth and Poverty Desk, and so one of the things that we were looking at was income inequality, and I think it's sort of well known around the country that Miami is a place where you find the very rich and the very poor. I don't think that I expected to see the extremes that we saw. If you heard the show this morning, we had a tour of Fisher Island, which is unlike anything I've ever seen. And then
I'm jealous of that, by the way.
Yeah, it was a nice
yeah.
show.
I
should have brought my bathing suit when I went over there. We could have probably taken a swim. They've got some really nice beaches. But the other thing that we saw was Liberty City, which I had never seen. You know, I've been coming to Miami for years, but I've never gone into many of the neighborhoods outside of the beaches. In fact, I will say one of the things that I learned was that Miami and Miami Beach are two separate cities. Who knew? But when we went to Liberty City and we were looking at the American Dream and what people thought of it, and I want to play a piece of tape that we got from a woman named Whitney Maxey, who is a community organizer at the Miami Workers Center. If we have that, can we play it?
I think these communities definitely show that the American dream is an illusion. And I think one misperception is that people in communities like Liberty City, don't want to work hard, or they don't want to do this, or they don't want to do that. But the reality is, I mean, and you look around, there's not a lot of opportunity here.
So a very different version of the American dream than what we found, I mean, not just in Fisher Island, obviously, but in Little Havana and other parts of the city, talking to different people and different income levels, they had a very different view. So the idea that there are so many Miamis within Miami and within Miami-Dade County anyway, It was pretty interesting.
I told you that last week when we had discussed this. I said, well, you're going to find that disparity between wealth and poverty, and that's a big thing with Marketplace, the Wealth and Poverty Desk, and you guys did a good job of finding that with Liberty City and Fisher Island. You also discussed real estate with one of the richest men in the country and here in South Florida about the real estate market and how closely tied we are as far as our recovery to that real estate
market. The billionaire condo king, George Perez, who I guess reluctantly is called the Donald Trump of the tropics. I'm not sure he loves that that tagline, but
he's got better hair.
Well, he was really interesting, and the thing that he said, and I think this is one of the things that we reported that got a lot of coverage outside of Miami. People really took this seriously. I was seeing tweets from real estate people all over the country. Was this?
We are at the beginning of a new real estate boom. There's almost no inventory left. So we've seen prices increase substantially in my business, which is the condominium business, all over South Florida, but particularly in Miami.
Now, South Florida, of course, was one of the epicenters of the housing bust. We all know that. I think a lot of people probably heard what George Perez had to say and thought, oh, I guess I missed my opportunity to go buy a cheap house in South Florida because now, as he said, it's in a boom. Now, we should be clear. He obviously has an interest in saying that there's a real estate boom going on. He can make money when everyone else starts to go in and buy as he does. But the fact that he said it is still interesting.
Well, you did some really very fascinating work this week in really exploring South Florida, Miami. You learned a lot about the region. And some of the stuff is on our website, a lot of it, in fact, at WLRN.org. And you can listen back to some of the stories if you missed them. This morning's story on Fisher Island was great. And on if you have not heard the whole series, please do. One of the things that we're embroiled in here, we're not going to have time to play all the sound associated with this. So we only have a couple of minutes, but the stadium situation here with the Miami Dolphins. And this is something that you report on around the country about stadium issues. And the Dolphins got the first stage, at least, in getting the Miami-Dade Commission's approval 9-4 for improvements to Sun Life Stadium. And this would urge lawmakers in the state to raise the mainland hotel bed tax, the Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau, not Miami Beach, by a penny, and also add an additional $3 million a year for 30 years in sales tax revenue for the team. The commission is in favor of this. So the legislature, though, may not be. But just, Jeremy, how does this resonate around the country?
Well, you know, I mean, one of the first things when I got down here, I you know, checked into the hotel, turned on the TV, and this was the issue they were talking about on the local news. And I wasn't aware of it from the outside that there was this big stadium fight going on. But it is something that all cities around the country have to figure out. Are we going to throw money into whether it's a sports arena or any other kind of attraction that will bring? But the it was perfectly said by Doug Hanks of the Miami Herald when we talked to him. He said,
frequent panelist,
this is an issue of Miami wanting to be the playground of the rich and famous. We love the idea of having a Super Bowl here. We love the idea of having LeBron James and the top talent in the NBA here in Miami and really showing off as a top-tier city. Now, that attracted a lot of attention, that we said that he said that. And I was kind of surprised because I think from the outside, in New York, in Los Angeles, we do look at Miami as one of the top tier cities of the country, as a place where obviously there's a lot of culture and a lot of interesting things. And I was surprised that people in Miami were so surprised that we said that.
Well, I think that in the light of what happened with the Marlins Stadium and the fact that the team just sold off and traded a lot of its best players and the financing deal, which Doug wrote about this week, and how $95 million turns into $2 billion in over 40 years. A lot of people are looking at that, and that's clouding this Miami Dolphins situation. They're saying maybe these Super Bowls are not worth it. And every economist you talk to will tell you there's no substantive result in the region hosting a Super Bowl.
Well, and I will say, you know, the woman that you heard from in Liberty City just a couple of minutes ago, she did bring this up organically. We didn't ask her about it. She brought it up and she said, I can't believe they're thinking about throwing money into this when we're sitting here with, you know, housing projects that are being closed down and people are not getting the education they need and all that.
All right. Well, Jeremy, bring back the suntan and the stories to New York.
Not much of one,
yeah,
but
you're all there,
a little
light there. Yeah. But Jeremy, thanks for coming in this week. It's been fun.
It's been great being here, and thanks for hosting us.
All right, and Greg Allen, you'll be back. It was always good to
visit
with you.
Yeah.
Derek Cam from the Palm Beach Post, thank you for your time. As always, we'll catch up to you during session.
Great. Shout out to Aunt Rita in Miami.
She's got everybody to shout out, and the daughter. Your daughter's in St. Petersburg, so say hi to her too. Anyway,
hi, Leela.
If you haven't seen the photos of former Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Alvarez, who's now a bodybuilder competing in the over 60 division, when we saw these pictures, we had to do a double take. But they're actually online at her website, WLRN.org, along with every place
else.
You
have to watch the video.
Exactly. The Florida Roundup's produced by Alicia Zuckerman, Elaine Chan, our associate producer, Public Insight Network analyst Steph Farrow, social media editor is Danny Rivero. Our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Meritz. For WLRN Miami Herald News, it's Dan Gretsch. Technical supervision extraordinarily handled by Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next, but Saturday it's only a game. Until next week, thanks for listening. I'm Phil Latzman, and stay informed, South Florida.